Your local radio. Across central southern Dorset.
Keep 106. Keep 106.
You are listening to Ridgeway Magazine with John Shepherd and Andy Fenton.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good things are coming.
Hello and welcome. We're live in the studio and ready to go. In the programme today, we shine a light on a new phenomenon in big business, the happiness officer, charged with bringing joy to the workplace. Our two regular contributors, Ruth with her gardening tips and Jim Potts, our poet at large, with thoughts on spring, join us at the microphone. And I visit the newly opened Weymouth Repair Cafe, where they were fixing anything from a Dyson to a Dalek. And there's more, isn't there, Andy?
Yes, there is. March is a will-writing month, with charities throughout the area benefiting from work through local solicitors who will draw up a will in return for a donation. While on the subject, the Law Society's spokeswoman emphasises the importance of making a will. We give you a taste of what is planned for visitors to Weymouth this year, and we report on why folk in two Weymouth neighbourhoods are appealing against a new Tesco convenience store's drinks licence application. Now, are you happy in your work? What do Amazon, Google and Airbnb have in common? Well, apart from the fact they're tremendously successful companies, they all have a CHI among the ranks of senior executives. The letters CHI stand for Chief Happiness Officer. For all of us in the past who worked 9 to 5 with a break at lunch, there was a sort of mafia rule of omerta. Keep quiet, don't rock the boat, and don't complain. If it was a rotten job, just get on with it and try and find a better one, was the unenlightened attitude. But in today's workplace, whether it's an office or a factory, things are changing. According to the business contact site LinkedIn, there are nearly 400 happiness officers in London-based companies. So, what does a happiness officer do, and why do they play a key role in business and industry? The last 2 years have changed the working environment as no other. People had to work from home largely unsupervised. Colleagues no longer met and talked to each other. Meetings around the table, brainstorming sessions, and snacks and meals taken with colleagues no longer took place. Many employees felt cast adrift. It was particularly difficult for graduates and people who had just joined companies to learn not only their new employer's corporate culture and mission statement, but also to learn the job by watching and talking to colleagues. Flexible working from home might have been a splendid notion to start with, but pressures of coping with children, finding a workspace, or simply sharing the kitchen table with files, documents and a laptop was not conducive to peace and harmony. This workplace upheaval might well have contributed to a figure widely reported recently, namely that 250,000 people aged between 50 and 65 have left their jobs and are not looking for another one.
So back to the question, what does a happiness officer do? It seems the concept started in Silicon Valley, or where else. There have been all sorts of faddish ideas to keep staff happy, from bringing your dog to work, dressing down, throwing softballs around the office, coffee and snacks on demand, an in-house gym, and selecting what days and where you are prepared to work, hosting theme nights and parties to celebrate company and personal achievements. To those of us stuck in a mundane job in Dorset, it all sounds, well, pretty naff to a certain extent, and enlightened, possibly, on the other hand. But there is a purpose. Wellness and well-being at work lowers staff turnover and helps attract the best talent. In Silicon Valley and in high-pressure jobs, think lawyers and those high earners in the City of London, burnout is common among those bursting to become the big achievers and the big earners. There are the sorts of businesses where a happiness officer is employed to spot burnout, and other damaging traits like alcohol and drug abuse, and to encourage employees to come forward, talk about problems in the spirit of cooperation rather than confrontation. Some companies call these sessions happy talks. Challenges for happiness officers involve building an atmosphere in a company where teammates can create and share high levels of trust and camaraderie. Difficult enough to do in an office environment, but even more difficult to create when people are working remotely. We invited Gemma Lavitas, who's joined us before on Ridgeway Magazine, to give her view on workplace happiness. She is a clinical psychotherapist and a life coach, and advises and mentors graduate and staff at universities and colleges in London. And here she talks to me.
How about this for a slogan? Be happy in your work. I'm sure it comes from a book on a totalitarian state. But there is a thing about being content in your work, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. It's really important for people to feel content and happy in the workplace because it gives them more confidence. It helps in their daily lives. So keeping people happy and trying to, you know, create a working environment that is conducive to happiness is really important.
I always thought work was sort of a rather serious environment.
It's definitely a positive. It's really important for people to feel comfortable and confident in their workplace, certainly.
But what steps then do employers take to make their employees happy? I mean, when I worked in marketing and advertising, it was always said, that your staff left by the front door every night and you hoped that they would come back by the front door every morning, because there was a certain sort of volatility in that kind of environment, that kind of work. So what is the answer today then to keeping your staff?
It's helping staff understand that, you know, as an employer, their well-being is a priority for you, because if your staff are happy in their workplace, in their role, in their job, and they feel like their employer is interested and invested in their well-being, then they're much more likely to stick around. And, you know, one of the big problems for employers is retention of staff. They want to keep their staff because it's really expensive to have a high turnover of staff, you know, have people joining and then leaving shortly afterwards. Cost employers a lot of money. So their investment is all about helping staff feel confident in their role so that they will stay.
Okay, so are you saying then that in order to keep people to stay, what should the sort of the human resources aspect of a large company do then? I mean, how do they ensure that their staff are content? I mean, a lot of the gripes that used to be in the workplace was, nobody listens to me.
Well, mental health is a huge importance. It's really important for people to keep an eye on each other in the workplace, you know, to be aware of each other's well-being, and that there is an open forum, that there are steps that an employee can take if they are struggling, if they are having problems, you know, that they can go and see somebody. Perhaps that's what this happiness officer, perhaps that's part of their role, that they are somebody that employees can approach and can talk to confidentially about how they're feeling.
Well, now, perhaps Dr. Albert Schweitzer summed it all up when he said, and I quote, "Success is not the key to happiness. Happiness is the key to success. If you love what you're doing, you'll be successful." And I think there's some truth in that. And now spring is sprung, the grass is riz, and in the studio our garden expert is. Oh, what terrible scansion. Who writes this stuff? Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning, everyone.
The magazine Gardening, Amateur Gardening. So what's that I see in your truck basket today?
It's our post bag. It's this is one of the busiest time of years in the garden, and our readers bombard us with letters for advice of what to do with various bits and pieces.
Just as well, we're just down the road from the sorting office, isn't it?
It is indeed, so I didn't have far to come.
So question number one.
Well, a lot of people at this time of year They've bought lovely scented bulbs to grow indoors at Christmas, force bulbs, things like hyacinths, crocus, paperwhite narcissi. And they say, what do I do with them now? They're dying back, the flowers have died, the leaves look a bit rubbish. What should I do with them? Should I just chuck them away? And the answer to that is no, don't, because you can, well, you've got two options. You can either just let them die back and keep them dry and somewhere dry and cold through winter, through summer rather, getting ahead of myself, and then plant them up in autumn to grow again next year. Or you can plant them in the garden where they may not do as well next year, but after that they will gradually come back and each year they'll give you a better display.
So they get used to it.
They do. They mature, they harden off. The only ones you really can't do that with are the paperwhite narcissi, because they are quite tender. And obviously, you know, the big amaryllis, the big hippiastrums with the big trumpets, they are sort of from South Africa, so they wouldn't be really too happy in our garden. But things like hyacinths, crocuses, they all do well in the garden.
Oh, that's good news. Actually, I have grown amaryllis.
What, in the garden?
No, I've grown them in pots.
Yes.
Outside.
Oh, have you?
Yes,
then
I
you
have.
Bring them in autumn.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
But they didn't last forever. But I did manage to, you can separate the I don't know if you call it a bulb.
Yeah.
And so you can make two out of one. And they actually worked quite well for a period of time.
Yes, and then
and then they all gave up.
They run out of steam.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. And also, of course, with bulbs in pots, you've got vine weevils, which will eat them.
But they were lovely when they were growing.
They're
absolutely gorgeous.
Beautiful, yeah. Yes.
And everybody said, you can't do it.
And you did. Well, that's good. Well,
but it's sheltered, you see.
Yes.
That's the thing.
Yeah, that is. I mean, if you have a warm, sunny spot that is sheltered, no sort of cold breezes, yeah, you'll
anyway,
have more success.
Take us into your post bag.
The other thing is, obviously, trees are coming back into leaf now, sort of deciduous trees and everywhere, sort of looking slightly hopeful and green. But we get a lot of people writing in saying, my tree, or a certain tree, or a couple of trees, have died in the winter. Why and what can I do? And the most common problem generally is a fungal disease called honey fungus. And that once your tree has honey fungus, it will die. There's nothing you can do. I mean, some fungal diseases are treatable with fungicides and by cutting out the affected bit of plant, but honey fungus will kill your tree. It shows itself above the ground with sort of yellow gold toadstools around the trunk, around the base of the trunk. And if you dig up a little bit of root, it'll look slightly white and it'll smell of mushrooms. And if you cut it in half, it'll have a black centre. And so once your tree has honey fungus, all you can do is chop it down and, if possible, remove the stump as well and put fresh soil in.
I see. Okay, well, that's letter number two.
Not a very happy topic for a Wednesday morning, but, you know, it is common and it is a problem, so, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I've seen plants or rather shrubs with sort of fungusy type, you know, around the bottom.
Yeah.
So that means it's pretty terminal, does it?
If it's of that certain type, if it is a yellowy golden fungus and you get these funny smells and
yes.
colouring of the roots, then yeah. yes. There is another disease called root rot, Phytophthora, which rots the roots, and that, again, is a terminal case, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, I've got some plants which don't look as though they've survived the winter. I do that sort of scratch test, you know. But hydrangea, I have got two hydrangeas, actually, which seem to have turned up their toes, and I can't think why. They've been very well fed.
So when you do the scratch test, there's not green underneath the bark?
That's right.
Are there any signs of shoots coming up from the soil? New growth?
No, not at the moment.
Yeah, I've got a hydrangea in a pot, and it's just starting to throw up new leafy shoots right at the base, in the centre. I'd leave it another couple of weeks, see what happens, and then it might be bye bye.
Yes.
I mean, plants die, unfortunately, like the rest of us. It's what they do, is what we do, you know. So
actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we'll talk about wills later in the program.
Oh, well, there you go.
All right, so more from your post bag.
Another common query is about seed sowing, because everybody wants to, you know, start growing things at this time of year. And some seeds, hardy annual seeds can be sown directly into the soil now because it's warming up and we've got, as today, spring showers. But, you know, the temperatures are generally warmer and during the night as well, not as cold. And hardy annuals are obviously hardy. So they can be sown outside. But half hardy annuals, which are things like your cosmos, your zinnia, the sort of quite gaudy summer flowers we all love that are annual favourites, they need still to be sown undercover, germinated on a windowsill or in the greenhouse.
Right. OK, well, more from your postbag. Don't stop yet.
The other thing people want to know if they can plant are things like dahlias. You know, you get dahlias and gladioli and lovely Alstroemeria, which is always a bit of a mouthful, which actually I planted some out yesterday. And they're those lovely sort of tall lilies. And people say, can we plant them out now? And some you can. I would say yes, do plant out your gladioli. Do plant out your Alstroemerias and other ones. But things like dahlias and canna lilies, start them off in pots in the greenhouse or in a sunny porch or on a windowsill because it's still a wee bit cold and damp out there.
Have I done the wrong thing because I didn't lift my dahlias? They're still in the ground.
It all depends what your soil's like and what your garden's like. If you've got free-draining soil, they should be fine. And if you gave them a bit of a mulch with straw or something. I mean, my parents used to live down in Preston and they had a massive dahlia in the garden that Dad just left in the ground all year. And it came back year after year.
Yeah.
I haven't had that much luck. I think it all depends on where it is and what your soil's like and how sheltered the area is. Generally now, if I'm growing dahlias in pots, I'll bring the pot into the greenhouse at winter. And if I'm starting off new tubers, I'll start them off undercover.
Right. Does anybody ever ask you a question about clematis? Should you chop them back?
It depends. You could do a whole programme on clematis. There's different groups, different times of flowering. If you have, say, one of the lovely clematis that flower in winter and are just starting to go over now, they don't need much cutting back. Just trim off the dead heads, tidy them up a bit. Some of the other clematis that flower, let's say, they're called Group 2 and Group 3 clematis, and they flower in early summer. And then if you deadhead them, then they may have another flowering in autumn. They do need cutting back now. You need to cut them back to about a foot above the ground to a healthy pair of leaf buds. Otherwise, they'll just keep growing each year, and all the flowers will be up at the top, and you'll have nothing to see at eye level. So well, they do need cutting back.
I don't know about your Group 1 and Group 2. My clematis is called Common or Garden.
Ah, when does it flower?
I haven't got a clue about it. Oh, it flowers very nicely when it decides to flower. Well, actually, for quite some time during the summer, and the blooms are quite big. I'm not very good at describing clematis.
What colour are they?
Sort of lilac-y white.
Right. Are the petals striped?
Yes.
Nelly Moser. It's a Nelly Moser. Pale pink and white.
No, it's more blue.
Ah. There's so many, and I'm not a clematis expert.
I said it's a common or garden.
Yeah, a common or garden one.
It's called inherited clematis.
That very, very common variety.
But I think what I'll do is, though, I think because it has got very, very bushy at the top, I think I will experiment and cut it right back
and see what happens. Yeah, or just cut a few of the stems back and see how they behave, and then feed it. Feed it with a high potassium fertilizer.
I think it's
fertilizer.
It's going to be a bit all or nothing, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, cut it back to about a foot above the ground to a healthy bud, maybe 2 foot. Feed it and water it. And the other thing to say to readers, if you do want to plant a clematis, they like sun. But they like shaded roots, so plant them deep and cover the root area with lots of compost.
Well, I cover actually with, oh dear, probably doing the wrong thing, with broken up flower pots.
Yeah, all that, yes.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that's all right.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and just keep the soil damp, yeah.
Now, I've got time for one more letter.
Well, actually, do you know what? That was actually all I bought in today because I thought the chat would take longer. So if you have any questions, ask away. And
Do I have any questions? I've always got a question about roses.
Yes, yeah.
Actually, mine are sort of a growing beautifully in terms of, you know, leaf, new leaves, etc. So should I start feeding them?
Yes, yeah. Feed them now. Feed them with... You can get proprietary rose fertilisers because roses are hungry. They're greedy plants. So, but if you don't have that, something like Growmore or Vitex Q4, Blood, Fish and Bone, dig that in around the roots. Be careful when you're forking it in because their roots are quite shallow and you can damage them. If you damage rose roots, they send up suckers, which are... When you buy a variety of rose, the actual variety is grafted onto the rootstock, and the roots can be sort of any old rose. So, and these suckers will come up, and they won't flower like your rose. So you just need to pull them off. Don't cut them because they'll just come back stronger. Pull them off at ground level. But then when you fed them, give them a water, mulch them with some well water compost, and they'll go like the clappers.
As always, Ruth, very good advice and pleasure for joining us. It's always
it's a
treat to have you on the show, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time. Thank you.
Keep 106, your local radio.
Thank you very much indeed, Ruth. Always lovely to see you. Now then, our next studio guest has arrived. It's our very own poet at large, Jim Potts, and he is taking spring as his theme for some readings today, which is just as well because looking out the window, it's not very spring-like at all. It's pouring with rain at the moment. Jim, hello. Welcome to Ridgeway Magazine once again. The microphone is yours.
Thank you very much, Andy. Well, I was thinking of breaking into song, but I'll spare you that. So, but this is a song, a little song from Shakespeare's As You Like It, and it's very spring-like. If you'd like to sing it, John, you're very welcome.
Oh, yeah, all right. Okay. I'll give it a go, Jim.
Well, it was a lover and his lass with a hey and a ho and a hey nonny no that o'er the green cornfield did pass in springtime, the only pretty ringtime when birds do sing hey ding-a-ding-a-ding. Sweet lovers loved the spring. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about gardens in Pambury, from Shakespeare
do.
To Pambury.
Let's go to Pambury, yes.
But not just Pambury, a little bit beyond as well. Gardens in Pambury are usually not very large, but at my age, that's not a disadvantage. One of the attractions of coming to live in Pambury, which I still prefer to call Dorchester, was the convenience factor to have a house in Dorset that we could sometimes lock up and leave in order to visit friends and family overseas. It's a curious reason for buying a house, you might say. The last 2 years put severe limitations on the possibility of travel, but the small garden has been very manageable and a godsend during pandemic lockdowns. We felt profound sympathy for those who live in apartments without access to even a small garden. Of course, life was even more difficult for those in care homes, and it's a bit worrying that the government's just issued new guidelines for care homes on March the 15th. Being able to go for a walk or a cycle ride or to potter in the garden made the colours of spring seem brighter than ever before. I'd often go for a walk on Maiden Castle listening to the skylarks or my iPod for music suitable for that day. The great field has also been a boon for many at most levels of fitness or disability. The impressive new play area full of wooden structures and timber structures is expected to open later in the spring. I'm not quite sure when, but we're all looking forward to that. I hope I don't get stuck in the slide.
What, at your age? Well, I think it's very brave of you to go on the slide in the first place.
Well, it's the tube is the one that worries me.
When no, it's the steps. The steps, isn't it, really?
It's a problem. But when I can, I do walk with a group called the Pambury Pathfinders. I'm absolutely hopeless at finding paths myself, so I'm a follower rather than a leader. Anyway, I'm very grateful that they introduced me to such an extraordinary diversity of Dorset landscape. I was immensely grateful to them. My wife and I love to go swimming at Overcombe Bay in Preston near Weymouth, usually starting in May or late May. So that's been an annual inspiration, especially when the seals come to visit. The garden has brought incalculable pleasure to my wife, and our visits to the local garden centre and Dorchester Market always ended with a new plant, a pot or a wooden planter box. And the blackbirds became very tame, very, very welcome visitors. This year, we hope to spend much of the spring and early summer in Greece, Much as I love the English spring, the bluebells and wild primroses, there's nothing more beautiful to me than the coming of spring in Greece. It arrives early and vibrantly on Corfu, a month later up in the mountains where we often go on the mainland. The poet and novelist Glyn Hughes, who was an old friend, sadly deceased, writes of the Greek spring sweeping northwards in waves from the south. This is the bit from his poem. Following the first timid events, crocus, saxifrage, white daisies that turn to the light like faces of a theatre crowd following the action, spring was flung from over the sea horizon south. Wave after wave came. I could not work, but every day had to go out and look and worship at what had come to amaze us before it passed on in spasms northwards. My wife, Maria Strani Potts, as she writes in her novel of life in Corfu called The Cat of Porto Vecchio, describes it when it's a bit colder. Porto Vecchio, which is her name for one of the ports in Corfu, was in hibernation. The 40 days of Great Lent with its strict food regulations made Louisa even sadder. Because the weather was bad, the fishermen avoided going to sea. March, with its cold, wet and windy days, forced the children inside. By April, there were signs of spring emerging from the winter gloom. The snow on the Albanian mountains across the water was melting and running down into the sea, chilling it further. As tiny leaves and blossom began to appear on the trees and in every garden, flowers started to bud. The fishermen of Porto Vecchio began to think of putting their boats back into the water. Well, I have to admit that I fell in love with my wife-to-be among the long-stalked daisies on the island of Corfu in the spring of 1968. For me, this lover and his lass went out walking among the olive groves, not the green cornfields of England. Geoffrey Chaucer wrote of the cult of the daisy and of his deep affection for that modest flower, which is probably why I always read the prologue to his poem, The Legend of Good Women in the Spring. I will finish, if I may, with a couple of short poems.
Please do.
Yeah, I'm not sure my 6 minutes is nearly there, but...
Perhaps one short poem.
Okay, well, maybe two. There's one called The Birth of Love. Though rooted in the scowling rock face, daisies break out and smile at the sun. Another one quickly from Corfu, called The Cult of the Daisy, in fact. Lying amongst olive trees and long-stemmed daisies, I'm counting my springs.
I envy you with your time in Greece. Lovely place to be. Anyway, Jim, thank you so much for coming in and for your readings. We hope to see you next time. And now I'm afraid it's a total change of subject, isn't it, Andy?
Yes, it is indeed. A very serious subject, I'm afraid. Up and down the country, charities of all sizes and interests are being supported in a national fundraising drive in which local solicitors are offering a will-making service in return for a donation to good causes. The value of the donation is up to the client, but in normal circumstances, a solicitor will charge about £150 for the service. Best to get the job done properly, with all the legal requirements correctly written, taking advantage of the savings by making a sensible donation. Now, here's a fact. Only 46% of the adult population in the UK leave a valid will, a slight increase in recent years. As MoneySavingExpert.com discovered in a recent survey among its readers, the proportion of people leaving a will increases with age, up to 83% in those aged over 80, which is probably not surprising. But research among the respondents threw up another figure. Up to 20% of their respondents had a will which was not up to date. For a guide to the will-making month of March, John spoke to Melinda Giles of the Law Society's Wills and Equity Committee for her advice on the subject.
Good afternoon. Well, there's two main reasons why it's important to write a will. The first is that without a will, no one would know what you really want to happen to your assets or indeed for your funeral or any other aspect of your life without a will. The second reason is that if you don't make a will, then the state's provisions come into effect, and the outcome of that may be that people inherit from you that you may not have wanted to. There are a lot of assumptions as to who inherits, such as your spouse will inherit everything, and these are not necessarily correct. It depends very much upon the way in which you own assets and the value of those assets and your family circumstances.
Now, why is it so many people don't leave a will? It's very difficult, actually, to ascertain exactly how many people don't leave a will, but I'm told it's something about 30%.
Yes, I believe that is correct, and we don't really know why. It could be simply that people don't like to think about their mortality, which is understandable, and we did see an increase in will-making during the pandemic when we were faced with the idea of our mortality every day on the television. But I think the other reason is that people maybe think it's going to be more complicated and are afraid to open that can of worms, or conversely, they may think it's quite simple and they don't really need one, that everything will go where they think it's going to go. So we don't actually know the real reason. What we do know is very often when we sit with people who have decided to make a will, they're quite shocked at what would happen to their estate had they not had a will. So that shows you that they're mistaken quite often, sadly.
Can you say the sort of things that would go wrong then if you haven't left a will?
Yes. Where somebody may be married with young children and may assume that the entire estate goes to their spouse and that the family would be secure, but say the family home is in the name of the person that has died and is worth over a certain amount of money, that would mean that the whole family home doesn't pass to the spouse, because only a first proportion of your estate goes to your spouse, and thereafter it can have to be held in trust for your children. Now, that can be very problematic if you've got young children, because then you have a trust created for little children, which is quite a complicated thing to have. So, for example, that can go wrong. Unmarried couples with children, nothing will pass to the unmarried partner and the parent of young children left bereaved, for example.
I see, so all sorts of very difficult complications. And also, I suppose, what interest does the government have in somebody who passes and hasn't left a will? I'm thinking about taxation and inheritance tax.
Yes, well, there's two interests that the state, the government may have. Ultimately, if somebody dies without a will, without a spouse, without any children, without any brothers, parents or brothers and sisters, if they don't have many relatives, then actually the estate can pass to the state. So that's one outcome. But in terms of inheritance tax, when you make a will, you do get the advice about inheritance tax, and therefore you can potentially make a tax-effective will, or understand at least where inheritance tax would be paid. Whereas if you haven't had that advice and haven't made a will, it may be that the government or the HMRC do receive more inheritance tax than they would otherwise have done.
I see. I suppose that could apply to unmarried couples.
Certainly it applies to unmarried couples, but also in the scenario that I gave, where a married couple but they haven't got a will and part of the estate passes in trust to the children, had a will been made that passed it all to the surviving spouse, then that entire estate would be tax exempt, because a spouse is tax exempt, whereas the children are not.
I see. If you can, explain to me. I mean, there's a sort of view that if you write a will on the back of an envelope, it's okay.
Yes. Well, I think I would mislead everybody if I said that a will written on the back of an envelope is always invalid, because it actually could be valid in that the back of an envelope is a piece of paper, and if it's written clearly and witnessed in the correct way by two independent witnesses, there is a small possibility it will be valid. But of course, there's much more to it than writing a valid will. Not only has it got to make provisions that are valid, i.e. in the way it's written, but it's also the way it's signed. A will has to be signed by the person making the will in the presence of two witnesses who must all be there at the same time and sign to that effect. So there are two parts to a will being valid.
I see. So basically, the advice is, if you have the opportunity in the next month, go to a solicitor who's a part of the charitable endeavour to raise money through writing wills. The advice is, go to a solicitor and get it done.
Yes, and I would say that all solicitors have to be open and transparent on fees. So don't be afraid that you're going to go to a solicitor to make a will and get a shocking bill that you didn't expect. You know, you can ask at the outset how much it's going to be and you will pay the fee that's quoted.
Now, moving on. In our last Ridgeway magazine, we reported the Repair Cafe in Weymouth was about to reopen in new, larger premises in the community centre in Littlemore off Louviers Road. Well, it now opens regularly on the second Saturday of every month between 10:30 and 12:30, the next date being April the 9th. We sent John along with his Ridgeway magazine digitally enhanced wired for sound outside broadcast bicycle to record the proceedings. So tell us what you found, John.
Well, it is just as well the community centre has a large car park because word had got around and it was packed. Good news for the organisers. Worried about the change of venue, I thought as I freed my trousers from the bicycle clips, no Lycra trues and drop handlebars for me. Thank you very much. Far too revealing. I joined the queue for, I suppose, what would be called the triage stage if it was a hospital. A lady receptionist with clipboard makes a note of the broken item. I was queuing behind a standard lamp, circa 1950, diagnosed with part failure, and said inoperable lamp was allotted to a part specialist at a table with instruments comprising screwdrivers, various, pliers, wire cutters, fuses, electrical testing meters, duct tape, and a live plug socket. Two large rooms are devoted to repair and maintenance, all staffed by volunteers who all sit behind tables. To give you an idea of the all-embracing nature of the Repair Cafe abilities, I saw about 20 specialists. There was the grinding specialist. He was sharpening garden shears. The ladies operating three sewing machines were busy doing what ladies do with sewing machines. Jewellery was being repaired, usually faulty clips, and replacing precious diamonds that had fallen out of their settings. Well, possibly delete the words precious and diamonds, but you get the idea. Among the items being fixed were lawn mowers, table lamps, vacuum cleaners, laptops and mobile phones, clocks of the mantelpiece variety, a CD player, and so help me, a Dalek in several pieces with electronic inwards comprising a mass of wires being investigated with a sonic screwdriver borrowed, I think, from Doctor Who. Will it ever exterminate again? Who knows? But I had the feeling it belonged to a grown-up rather than a little boy. So, leaving the noise and bustle of the halls, I talked to the chairman and founder of the Weymouth Repair Cafe, and this is what she told me. Ross Green, I'm absolutely amazed because the car park outside the community centre is chock-a-block. There must be 100 people.
We're here at the Top Club and, we've got 30 volunteers here today. We did encourage car sharing, so I hope they haven't filled the car park and put people off. But, it's not as busy as we used to be when we were at the Palm House. But this is our first event here at Top Club, and it'll take people a while to find us.
Well, yes. Now, what sort of things have people been bringing in to be fixed?
We've got vacuum cleaners, and I've seen a 1980s games console, and there's some sewing. I've seen the lining being sewn on some curtains. The hem is best stitched by hand, and some jewellery's being repaired. Garden shears are being sharpened, and I've seen the handle going back on a Port Merion china cup. Yeah.
Yes, because I've seen somebody's brought in a standard lamp. I think I've seen one or two laptops.
Yes, I'm not sure if the laptops are being repaired or just being used by our volunteers, but we do have, we can repair laptops and PCs. And we could also give advice to people on how to use their mobile phones and their tablets, maybe if it's even just how to send emails or how to transfer your photos to your PC or laptop.
I see, so it's technical advice as well as fixing things. Now, you told me in a previous interview that you were always looking for volunteers. So what sort of people are volunteers? If I go and talk to them today, what are the sort of jobs that they might have done in the past? And how come that they're so, shall I say, knowledgeable and, well, actually handy with their fingers?
We've got people who've been engineers, people who've worked at the Atomic Energy Establishment at Winfrith, and we have got someone who does IT equipment in schools, I was an engineer and then a software tester and marketing. We've got ladies who work in the medical field, and I'm trying to think what, librarian, everything. Yeah.
So really, people from all walks of life.
Yes.
Are you still looking for volunteers?
Yes, we need we need almost everything: mechanical, electronics, IT, sewing, and gluing, and particularly meet and greet as well. People who can greet people at the door, help to fill in the forms and make the whole event run smoothly and make sure that it's fun.
So what is the form then? When you arrive with your broken vacuum cleaner, what happens next? You've gone through the door, and what next?
You are met by Carla in the pink hat, who gives you one ticket for every item that you've brought in and a form. You sit down, you fill in your forms, and our meet and greeters will come and help you. So we don't have a physical queue. And then your form is sent through to the appropriate team. That would be mechanical, electronics, or sewing. And then when an appropriate repairer is ready to look at your item, then you're called through by name. And while you're waiting, you can have tea and coffee. But you watch the repairs, and you might pick up some more skills or the confidence to do things yourself. And then you complete the little feedback bit at the bottom, and you go to reception where you're invited to make a donation.
And do people donate?
People are very generous with their donations, and we have got an initiative today. We've actually got three initiatives going to help the Ukraine. And one is that after the event, we will donate as much as we can spare to Ukrainian appeals, and the organisation Sum Up will double our donation, so that they will match it. We've only got £26 in the bank account at the moment. But we will donate all we can. We've got other initiatives going for Ukraine, which is that people could bring in mobile phones that are lying on the bottom of the door of the drawer, and we will clean them off and try and get them to charities in the Ukraine or for Ukrainian refugees. And we've got another initiative, which is the sale of the book, The Crabchurch Conspiracy, written by Mark Vine. And Mark is donating all the proceeds from the sale of his book to the Ukrainian appeal, and it is a brilliant book. I'd already read it myself twice, and I've bought another copy.
Very good. Well, look, Ros, lovely to talk to you, and I'm going to try and meet one or two of the volunteer and see what they've been mending.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, Ros, they're talking about Ukraine, of course, and Russia is in front of mind for all the wrong reasons these days. We catch John now in reflective mood as he looks back at the notes he made when visiting Russia 4 years ago. He was only there for a couple of days and didn't meet any Russians unconnected with the tourist industry. And although for the first time ever visiting perhaps 20 countries with his recording machine, he was refused any interviews. So he kept his eyes and ears open, and this is what he told listeners in 2017.
Russia and St. Petersburg, the most surprising place I've ever visited. In 2 days, you can only get a snapshot of the country. Let's leave aside tourist Russia. Our guide, who didn't want to be interviewed live, gave us some idea of life in Putin's Russia. There are many problems and shortages and reduced services. There is a housing shortage, and we saw dozens of huge 25-story apartment blocks being built everywhere. Despite this, countless families still live in apartment blocks, one family to a room, sharing one kitchen and a bathroom, and in some regions, girls can marry at 14, but almost two-thirds of marriages end in divorce. The birth rate has fallen to less than one child per couple, 0.75%, in fact. Young men are conscripted into the army for a period of 5 years, although some exemptions are made if you've worked hard at your education and have studied and passed your university exams. In St. Petersburg, the grand avenues, there are dozens of them, with huge public squares surrounded by large buildings built in the 1800s, and they badly need cleaning. Everything is grey, the only colour being the magnificent palaces and churches with glittering gold ornamentation. And in the streets, I noticed men without socks and little colour in the people's clothing. And on the wide thoroughfares, in contrast, many Mercedes saloons and Range Rovers and top-of-the-range European cars, including a few Bentleys, were gliding by. But as our guide, who teaches English at university, acknowledged, the tough life is relieved with vodka, which seems to make the wheels go round. Andy.
Thank you, John. Now, Easter is on the horizon when thoughts in Weymouth turn to the coming tourist and visitor season. Having come through the last 2 years of stop-start restrictions, the town has shown remarkable resistance, particularly in the buoyant restaurant sector. To give listeners a flavour of what's to come, John had a word by telephone with Steve Davis of the Weymouth Town Council's events team.
I'm talking to the irrepressible Steve Davis of the events team for Weymouth Town Council. And it's going to be a terrific year, 2022, isn't it, for Weymouth as a destination?
Thank you, John, for that esteemed introduction. Yeah, we're very excited. I think we're all very aware the last 2 years have been very, very difficult for everybody. And obviously, the events in the town have suffered a sort of big setback. So we're really, really looking forward to coming back with a real bang this year. And as you've previously mentioned, the events program always very strong in Weymouth, but this year especially we're delighted obviously to join the Queen's Platinum Jubilee celebrations at the beginning of June. In fact, we're going to be calling June in Weymouth our patriotic year, and a lot of businesses are very keen to put the red, white and blue out for the Platinum Jubilee weekend. And of course, we're delighted to have our Armed Forces celebrations back on the 18th and 19th June, that magnificent parade on the sea of historical vehicles. I always personally think that's one of Weymouth's proudest moments of the year. And we're delighted after a couple of years when we haven't seen our veterans marching proudly along the seafront, to have that event back and recognised by the Ministry of Defence as one of the great Armed Forces events in Britain. So that'll be back, and as I said, a big patriotic June. In July, I think most people can remember what happened in 2012 and how proud Weymouth was for hosting the sailing events for the Olympics, for the London 2012 Olympics. We're just delighted to recognise that 10th anniversary. We're putting on our Weymouth Beach Sports and Community Festival, and the emphasis is on community. We're inviting a lot of local sports clubs to come forward and provide a taster session on the beach as part of that beach festival. So it's going to be great. I mean, obviously, the volleyball championships will be there. We'll even have some Commonwealth Games team members coming along to practice the final preparations for the Commonwealth Games in Scotland a week or two after. So very exciting summer we've got. And obviously that leads us all forward into the autumn where, again, we've got a great lineup of events for people to get involved in.
So tell me about things that everybody can really enjoy. I mean, are we going to have fireworks on the sands as we did in the previous years?
I always love fireworks, John, and judging by the crowds we had out last year, the appetite for fireworks, I think it's more than fireworks. I think it's about getting together and sharing the experience, because fireworks is ideally placed for that in the bay. So delighted to say that we've got an additional firework display to coincide with the Queen's Platinum Jubilee at the beginning of June. So that'll be very exciting. We've got beacon lighting at the Nose Fort, but I think what the crowd like is that fireworks in the bay. So we'll be cheering the Queen's Platinum Jubilee with a great display. Then, of course, our summer displays on a Monday evening, they're back. We've got three of them planned in for July. And, of course, the back end of the year, Guy Fawkes celebrations, one of my favourites. We have the giant beach bonfire, the fireworks, and, of course, the fairground and the Guy Fawkes competition. So fireworks, Sydney, back big and proud for Weymouth this year.
Can we just one thing? Are we going to have a carnival this year?
Carnival is still something that hasn't made a comeback. I think we lost it a couple of years before COVID. I know there's a lot of great community action behind the scenes. I noticed recently the rebuilding of the Weymouth and Portland roundtable group, for example. So it's something that we're constantly aware of. I've got fond memories of Weymouth Carnival over many, many years, and I think it's always a fantastic community celebration. But like all these big events, they do need a strong collaboration. So if people come forward, I'm sure the local council will be keen to put their hand up and support anybody who wants to come forward with a plan.
Tell me, Steve, does anybody count on their fingers how many tourists and how many visitors Weymouth might expect during the course of a year?
Well, from an event point of view, John, which you know I've been very much involved with, we estimate over 500,000 people come to Weymouth specifically for an event. I mean, that's not just to take part in it, take part in the sports event, the sailing events or the running events, the Ironman events, and then all the people who come and support those people, and then all the people who come along to actually spectate those people doing the event. So we estimate that over 500,000, which is an astonishing number. And as I said earlier, I really do feel that events are the heartbeat of Weymouth. It's what Weymouth does very well, and it does. We like to share those with all our visitors, and obviously that's great benefit to the local economy, whether it's accommodation, hospitality, or retail, and a great opportunity for the town.
Well, that's wonderful, Steve. Hail and hearty, Weymouth, in 2022. That's what we all want to hear. Thank you very much for talking to Ridgeway Magazine.
Now, this final story today may not seem to be very important, but it could be an indication of things to come. The main road into Weymouth from Dorchester passes through two neighbourhoods, Upway and Broadway. The boundaries are indistinct, but the area we're talking about is identifiable by the Royal Standard, one of the few remaining independently owned pubs in Dorset. Five doors down towards Weymouth is the smallish site of the former Mazda car showroom, which closed about 2 years ago. The vacant site has been the scene of much speculation, but now the secret is out. It's to become a Tesco convenience store. Whether it's needed or not is a matter of opinion, particularly as there's a well-run shop half a mile away called the Village Stores. But what has got the locals fizzing is Tesco's application for a licence to sell alcohol during antisocial hours. Whereas the pub and the existing shop might not much like the competition, the cause of an appeal to the booze licence is the Saturday night scenario. Tesco seeks to sell alcohol up to 10 p.m. Sunday to Friday, and locals have accepted that there's not much they can do to oppose that. But the nub of the matter is the 11 p.m. to midnight aspect of the licence, which residents say will encourage noise and disturbance. Tesco have employed a cunning plan to enable them to do this extra hours trading. By offering hot snacks in the shape of microwaved pies in the shop, it can show it's selling alcohol with hot food, thereby providing a meal service. It is this that is key to the extended licence and the neighbourhood's concerns. At the annual general meeting of the Upway Society, it was decided to formally appeal the proposed licence application. Chairman Mike Davis told Ridgeway Magazine that the late Saturday night trading would be disruptive in a quiet neighbourhood which, the pub apart, is all residential. He had done his own survey and found there was no other Tesco outlet in our part of Dorset that held a late night hot food and drinks licence. This, he told us, might be the thin end of the wedge. If this late licence is approved, what is to stop other convenience stores applying for a similar extension of their off-sales licence? A local resident made the point that customers in cars visiting the shop at that late hour will need to pull off the main road into the small parking area, and drivers and passengers might remain on site as they eat their snacks and consume the drink they'd just bought. A further point, though less charitable, made by a resident who did not want to be named, concerned drinking habits. She said, "I can foresee people from outside the immediate area having had a skinful troop up to the shop for more alcohol, sort of topping up. If that happens, prepare for drunken behaviour on our doorsteps. The licence is not needed, it's unnecessary, and it's going to be noisy." Well, the licensing subcommittee of the Dorset Council will consider objections at a meeting in April, when objectors can attend in person and make their representations. Now, we've got about a minute of the programme left. John, you've got our funny little book there.
Yes, two council workers on a site in Dorchester are surveying land they're about to dig up. The gaffer says to one of them, "You go and get the metal detector and check for pipework, and I'll get the kettle on and have a brew." The gaffer gets the tea going while the mate starts work. Half an hour later, the gaffer puts the paper down next to his mug of tea to find out how the work is progressing. And he finds his mate sitting on a wall scratching his head. "What's up with you?" the gaffer says. "There's pipe work all over the place. Look." The young worker sets off across the land, the bleeper sounding continuously as the detector passes in front of him. The gaffer watches him, laughing, and he says, "Are you soft or what? You've got steel caps on your toe boots."
Oh dear, oh dear. And that's from which little book, very quickly?
It's called Dorset Wit and Humour. It's published by Maximilian Gate, and you can buy it at Cowbury Garden Centre.
Marvellous, and that's it from this edition of Ridgeway Magazine. It's time for us to go. So from John Shepherd and myself, Andy Venton, for now, take care. And until next time, cheerio.
Keep 106, your local radio.